The content of the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic is for informational purposes only. The content is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you have heard on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Show. If you think you may have a medical emergency, call your doctor or 911 immediately. Focus on Females does not recommend or endorse any specific tests, physicians, products, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on the radio show. Reliance on any information provided by Focus on Females or others appearing on the show at the invitation of Focus on Females is solely at your own risk. Now, it's time for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. Here, we create clarity out of confusion and guide you through today's healthcare maze. Each week, we'll focus on a different medical topic with a guest expert answering your questions. Future topics and guests can be seen at www.focusonfemales.com. Call in between 12:30 and 1 p.m. on Sundays and present your case to our experts. To get involved with today's clinic, call now in Hillsboro, 289-1860, and everywhere else, 877-969-8600. Be proactive with your health. We're here to focus on you. And now, our host, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
The Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic is on, and we thank you for listening. Today, we're tackling atopic disease with guest expert Dr. Dennis Ledford, allergist, immunologist from the University of South Florida College of Medicine in Tampa, Florida. But first, this radio show and the free annual Focus on Females Women's Healthcare Symposium, now the largest in the country with over 1,000 women during each of our last two events, with a combined 7,500 hours of education during those 2 days, is supported by the not-for-profit Focus on Females Education Foundation, whose mission is to create an interactive, dynamic, community-based healthcare safety net, making you an expert on your personal medical needs. The result? Better partnering with your existing doctor, leading to more effective office visits, faster results, and reduced economic burden of avoidable medical and emergency care. We save lives and protect families through the immediate impact of direct with the expert health education. And as mentioned, today we are tackling atopic disease and with Dr. Dennis Ledford. And Dennis, it's nice to have you back with us today.
Steve, thanks for asking me to join you again. I enjoy these times together.
And Dennis grew up in East Tennessee, attending college at the Georgia Institute of Technology. He received his medical degree from the University of Tennessee Center for Health Sciences and remained in Memphis for the completion of his internal medicine residency, followed by fellowships in rheumatology and immunology at New York University and Bellevue Hospital, both in New York, and a fellowship in allergy and immunology at the University of South Florida. Dr. Ledford remained in Tampa at the University of South Florida, joining faculty and achieving professorship of medicine in 2000, working with doctors Richard Locke, Roger Fox, and Mark Lom, in supervising the training program in allergy and immunology. His clinical responsibilities occupy a majority of his time, but he has developed research interests in severe steroid-dependent asthma, allergen characterization, an association of gastroesophageal reflux disease and upper airway disease, continues to publish through special products and ongoing research work, including pharmaceutical-funded phase 2, 3, and 4 clinical trials. And again, another interest of his is atopic disease, and we'll explain what that is shortly. There's numerous honors and awards Dr. Ledford has won. We won't go into them at this time, if it's okay.
Yeah, that's fine.
We can take the rest of the hour just discussing those. And again, it's an honor to have you here, Dennis.
My mother would like to hear about this, but I said, Mom, tonight, Dave, we're not going to go through that.
Very good. Okay, so let's begin at the beginning. Atopic disease, every physician knows about it. I don't know if the public knows about it. Can you define it for our listeners?
Yes, Steve. Atopic disease refers to a genetic or an inherited predisposition to react to the environment in a very specific but unusual way, in the sense that it's not exactly beneficial, so that you're responding to the environment in a non-beneficial way immunologically. And usually that's associated with hay fever and asthma, but it also includes atopic dermatitis, allergic eye disease, and a variety of other problems that we really probably don't even recognize frequently. And so it's sort of a complex inherited tendency to react to the environment in an unusual way.
But how do you differentiate atopic, which, by the way, is, for those of you who want to do more research, is spelled A-T-O-P-I-C, atopic. How do you differentiate atopic from allergic?
Well, that's a confusing question for a lot of us, because often we use them almost interchangeably, and they really can't be. You can be allergic to a drug and not be atopic. Allergy refers to an immune response that is not beneficial. Atopy is a genetic predisposition to respond to usually benign or innocent things with an immune response that's characterized by IgE. So it's a specific type of allergy, I guess, but it's also inherited and refers to a generalized problem beyond just the allergy itself.
And one of the ways that diagnosis of atopy is made is with elevated IgE levels.
Well, that would certainly be one indicator, but elevated IgE could also occur from parasites. So it's really the family history of the physician or the professional obtains that indicates this tendency for groups in the family to be affected, and the sort of pattern of the presentation, often in children or infants starting with atopic dermatitis, which many of our listeners may have heard about. And then they hear about hay fever and asthma, and the word atopy is no longer used. But really, they're all part of the same disease process that we call atopic disease.
Of what importance is it to look beyond allergy as a reason for a person or a family's seasonal disorders or perennial year-round disorders, and to make a diagnosis or try to make a diagnosis of atopy? What benefit is it to the patient's family?
Well, I'm not certain there's a direct benefit other than understanding why this is happening, but it also helps you take care of other members of the family. Many times we will recognize a condition in a child, for example, and it was just unrecognized in the parent, and so this thing was inherited, but the parent never actually understood why they had a chronic cough, and it turns out they were atopic too. So I think there's understanding about why something happens, but we treat these conditions, whether you're labeled with atopic or allergic problems, we often treat them very similarly. So in that sense, it doesn't change the treatment.
I guess there's maybe one exception. That's in my world, the ophthalmology world, and the ocular surface. A patient with an allergic condition, allergic conjunctivitis, for example, will not form symblepharon or scarring of the eyelid to the eyeball, but patients with atopy or atopic conjunctivitis can. And when they form symblepharon or scarring from the eyeball to the eyelid, that can result in complications which can lead to loss in vision. So, but outside of that, it doesn't sound like it may make a big difference.
Well, that's an interesting observation, because the person who has allergic conjunctivitis, the less severe form, is still atopic. It's just that we don't call that atopic allergic conjunctivitis. We use the term atopic when it has that more severe component that's more chronic. So again, it's a question of severity and persistence, as well as some genetic elements we probably don't understand. When we say this is genetic, that doesn't mean we know the exact genes. It's probably a very complex set of genes, and some people have a lot of them, and some have fewer. So one child in a family, very severe, the other child, not as severe.
Okay. And so when you ran through a list of diagnoses that can affect the person and family with atopic disease, and so that includes, I guess the most common would be dermatitis.
Well, in the child, there's something called the allergic march. I think you could also call that the atopic march. And again, this is sometimes confusing with the terminology. But the allergic march or atopic march is that an infant has food sensitivity with atopic dermatitis or eczema, another confusing term because eczema means lots of different things. But atopic dermatitis when they're infants, they then often develop cough that's persistent with respiratory infection and frequent ear disease. and then later kind of become more wheezing with asthma diagnosis, and then ultimately have hay fever or allergic rhinitis. Along the course, they could develop atopic keratoconjunctivitis in the eye, or they may only have some mild eye inflammation in certain seasons. So that's the sort of sequence of events that include the atopic spectrum.
Okay, now let me go a little tangential here and ask this question. If a person that does not have atopy but yet has asthma, some wheezing, a cough, would they necessarily have elevated IgE levels in their blood?
Well, Steve, you ask very tough questions. Probably yes. It seems that IgE does correlate with the risk of asthma, but the atopic person tends to have much higher IgE, and they usually have IgE specific to allergens that cause problems, say cat or dust mite, as opposed to other asthmatics whose IgE seems to be somewhat elevated, but we can't measure specific IgE. We can't measure allergy on a skin test or a blood test to a certain allergen that likely causes mm-hmm. their problem.
And yet there's even another condition, just for the education of our listeners, called, I believe, hyper-IgE syndrome?
Yes, hyper-IgE syndrome is independent of atopy. And again, I think that's why you can't sort of put all your eggs in the IgE basket. Atopic disease is more than IgE. IgE makes us allergic to things. But again, people with eczema, for example, atopic dermatitis, lose water from their skin. They have reduced production of antibacterial proteins that fight off certain types of bacteria. They're missing components that make their skin resistant to certain chemicals. So now suddenly they're at risk of a lot of things other than just allergy.
Mm-hmm. Even viral diseases in addition to the bacterial diseases.
That's exactly correct. Patients with atopic dermatitis have increased risk of viral infections both on their skin as well as when they're vaccinated with something like smallpox.
Mm. And we should just, again, for the benefit of our listeners, IgE is a antibody?
Yes, IgE is one of those proteins in our blood that's made by our immune system, that system that adapts to our environment. IgE is a protein in the blood that is measured by doctors when they're trying to find out if you are, quote, allergic to something by detecting IgE to these substances. IgG, for example, is another of these proteins, but that tends to fight infection or protect us from certain infections, whereas IgE doesn't seem to protect us from bacteria, but might protect us from parasites like invasive worms and other parasites that might occur in other parts of the world.
Okay, and then yet another condition I recall is, eosinophilia or eosinophilic syndrome?
There's a variety of eosinophilic syndromes, and the eosinophil is often associated with allergy and atopy. But again, you can have eosinophils for other reasons. Drug allergy would be an example where you have eosinophils but no atopic disease. But typically, you see elevation of the eosinophils in the blood as well as in the nose and the eye, and often in the skin of patients with atopic diseases. But you can have eosinophils from other reasons, including parasites.
And a rapid definition of an eosinophil.
Eosinophil is a cell that looks red, and eosin was the name of a coloring agent that a famous doctor discovered that would label these cells. So they're basically cells that look red under the microscope.
And they're in the white blood cell family.
Yes, they circulate in your bloodstream with the other cells in the blood, and then when they look at them under the microscope, they can recognize these cells as being that type of cell by the fact that they look red.
Okay. On the line is Emily. Emily, welcome to the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic.
Thank you.
And you are a patient of Dr. Ledford's?
Yes, sir.
Can you tell us something about yourself and how you came to be managed by Dr. Ledford for your medical condition?
I'm allergic to peanuts, and I have asthma.
Okay. How old are you, Emily?
I'm 14.
Okay. And how did you find that you had a peanut allergy?
When I was little, my mom had given me a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and I went into, I think it's called anaphylactic shock or something.
And where were you at the time?
At my house.
And what happened? How was that managed?
They took me to the hospital.
Okay, all right. So now, what is your understanding of what happened at that time?
Well, I was like 2 years old, so I don't really remember.
Okay. All right. So, well, now we have an expert with us. Peanut allergy. Is that, Dennis, is that, could that be part of the atopic spectrum of diseases? And if you could explain what happened to this young lady.
Absolutely. Food allergy is one of the early manifestations that we talked about with atopic dermatitis and food sensitivity. And Emily sort of characterizes that at the age of two, she had this reaction to peanut. And so it starts at a very early age, and it often even you can recognize this in utero or at the time of birth. You can detect that a child is prone to atopic diseases if you do some very sophisticated measurements. So Emily had become sensitized to peanut. Sometimes we don't even know why, because it sometimes will happen on the first ingestion of the food, and there's a lot of debate about how that occurs. But presumably she was exposed to peanut protein along the way. Then when she at two ingested it, it caused a severe reaction that is called anaphylaxis, as she correctly described. And again, that is part of the atopic spectrum, but you can have anaphylaxis and it not be due to atopic disease. But in her case, it was.
Can these proteins cross the placental barrier?
Probably. And that's one of the ways that people have argued that infants or children can be sensitized to a food prior to their actually ingesting the food, that when the mother ate the food, some of the proteins was in the bloodstream of the mother and crossed the placenta and was exposed then to the immune system of the child.
So, Emily, tell us, after that, you were 2 years of age at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so since then, obviously, you're careful about being exposed to all tree nuts and peanuts, or is it
I just stay away from all nuts.
All nuts, okay. And that could be difficult. That could be challenging because sometimes, I guess, ingredients are not necessarily listed, or all ingredients are not necessarily listed on wrappers and on the box of foods.
Correct.
So you have to be very careful. And you carry an EpiPen with you?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And so after that food allergy, the peanut allergy, what happened after that? You mentioned a couple other things you developed over time.
I developed eczema, and I have my asthma, and I used to be allergic to egg, but I outgrew that.
Okay. Is that typical, Dennis, to outgrow an egg allergy?
Yes, it is. There's some foods that are commonly, or sensitivity is lost over time. Other foods tend to be much more persistent, and Emily, again, very well characterizes egg and milk tend to be allergens that are fairly short-lived, relatively speaking. I mean, they can last until the child is between 5 to 10, and occasionally even longer than that, but typically they seem to disappear with time, whereas sensitivities to tree nuts, peanuts, fish, and maybe shellfish tend to be much longer lasting.
Mm. And there's no way we know at present to shorten the duration of sensitivity to those allergens.
We don't know definitely yet, but there is some experimental work underway at several institutions, including Duke and Arkansas and New York, using oral desensitization or progressive exposure to allow someone to become tolerant to the food. That might be a way of accelerating it. There's also some new tests that will help the doctors decide whether you are going to be likely to have this for life or you're more likely to lose it over time. Hmm. But those are still somewhat experimental at this time.
And just curious, is that with genetic modification of agriculture, or the use of genetic modification with crops and agriculture, does it make sense, or would it make sense to try and alter the peanut? Is the protein that known, for example, in the peanut, which actually causes this reaction, and can it be altered genetically?
Yes, the peanut protein that causes most of the reactions has been defined, and there's actually been peanut plants created that do not produce the allergen. But there's a lot of uneasiness about using genetically modified plants. And I think there's been some hesitation to introduce it widely to the food processing system.
So it hasn't really been tested yet on patients?
It has been tested, but not introduced widely, and I'm not certain it will be because of some of these philosophical and maybe real issues and concern about not knowing what the long-term repercussions might be.
Since you're an expert, we'd like to weigh in with your opinion.
I would favor that if we could modify the food by eliminating a protein like ARA-H2, which is the name of the major allergen in peanut, it would make some sense, but, you know, that doesn't eliminate all peanut proteins. And will Emily be comfortable in eating a modified peanut, and does that still put her at risk, and she might still prefer just to avoid the peanut? So in the big scope of things, it might not make that much difference.
But, Emily?
Yes?
Okay. So we talked a little bit about your tree nut, peanut allergy, talked a little about your eczema. Tell us about your asthma. When did that start?
started, but like now I carry around an inhaler and I take all this medication for it.
Okay. So you're pretty well under good control, it sounds like.
Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any questions for Dr. Ledford?
I do. It's about my peanut allergy. Okay. I have a three-part question for Dr. Ledford. First, if you were born with a peanut allergy, are you less likely to outgrow it? And if you do outgrow it, is there a chance that it could come back? And last, is there an age, if it hasn't, if you have not outgrown it, that you probably won't?
Boy, Emily, you're not only beautiful, you're very, very smart. I tell you, you ask some tough questions.
Oh, thank you.
The first part was, if you have the peanut allergy very early in life, are you less likely to outgrow it, I believe was the first question.
Right.
I would say that's probably true, that sensitivity that shows up very early before much exposure indicates that you tend to react much more aggressively to the protein. And that would probably indicate aggressively, meaning you have a stronger immune response to it. And that probably means you're less likely to outgrow it. But that's, again, not universally true. I'm just saying in general, that's probably the case. The second question, I think, had to do with, I'm sorry, I think you were, the age, was it the age that you outgrow it?
And if you do, like, outgrow it, is there a chance that it could come back?
The answer to that question is yes. There is a potential that if you reintroduce the food intermittently after you've, quote, outgrown this, that you could still become resensitized to the food. By intermittent, I mean you would eat it and then have long periods of time before you eat it again. And so typically, if you do outgrow it and want to have this in your diet, we would ask that you eat it fairly regularly to maintain that this your immune system doesn't begin to develop this allergic response. And I think you had another question, though, too.
If there is like an age when you haven't outgrown
yes.
it,
yes.
that you probably wouldn't.
Very good. Yes, I think in general, if you're going to outgrow it, it'll probably be your age to maybe 10 years later. In other words, you should be showing some evidence that you're outgrowing it over the next 10 years. But having said that, you have a long life ahead of you. And I think it's certainly still possible that we don't have all the answers to these questions you're asking, because often we didn't recognize these allergens in the past. So we don't really know at 50 years of age. I know that seems like so far from now for you that you can't imagine it. But at 50 years of age, you might outgrow it if you haven't at 25. But in general, we think that if you're going to outgrow it, it'll probably be in your 20s to mid-20s that you would tend to have that happen.
Good to know. Thank you.
Thank you, Emily.
Emily, thanks very much for sharing part of your Sunday with us today on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Continued good luck to you, Emily.
Thank you. Bye, Dr. Ledford.
Bye-bye, Emily. Sorry, Steve. Emily didn't mention about her eczema because she really had a challenging time. This is a very beautiful adolescent young woman, and throughout her childhood, her mother and she had to work hard to keep her skin care, because sometimes this will cause scarring of the skin, and she's done a fabulous job, and it is improving as she's getting older, but she still has drier skin, and she has to use more moisturizer, and there are some things that she does to make sure that this atopic dermatitis doesn't bother her as she grows into a young woman.
Emily, you still there? Okay. Dennis, would you like to comment on if you remember, what she has used to control her eczema?
Well, she's used a variety of agents, and again, her mother is fabulous, too. She works hard, and that's another point to digress, is that these diseases, atopic diseases, impact the family, because often you have more than one child affected and the parents affected, and there's a cousin with this, so it does impact the family, and that's why often for women, this is such a big problem, because they're often in charge of a lot of the family issues. The treatment is primarily moisturization and appropriate use of topical steroids. Many times food allergy contributes to this, and elimination diets will help, but sometimes it's not easy to define exactly which food. Like Emily said, she has anaphylaxis to peanuts. She doesn't eat peanut, but there may be other foods she's eating that could affect her eczema that she's outgrown by now, and that's why her eczema has improved. Or it could just be that she's gotten older, she's improved. But during that time of active disease, you had to be very careful with infections and treat them appropriately. Use topical steroids, not overuse them, but use them appropriately, and lots of moisturizers to keep the skin hydrated so it doesn't tend to be so prone to itching.
Do you sometimes use tacrolimus or other non-steroidal preparations as well?
Yeah, Steve, that's a big word for a class of therapies that are non-steroidal. We call those calcineurin inhibitors. Calcineurin, they inhibit a factor that makes lymphocytes go. And so what you're doing is kind of holding back the lymphocytes so that they won't be active. The lymphocyte is the immune cell in our body that produces IgE and affects these atopic diseases. So these topical agents are non-steroidal, meaning they don't have the effects of a steroid, but they can help you control eczema.
Okay. All right. And we're going to take a quick break and come back with more on atopic disease. We encourage everyone to call in now with your questions. It's 289-1860 in Hillsborough County, 289-1860. Everywhere else is toll-free, 877-969-8600. We'll be right back with more with Dr. Dennis Ledford.
The Gulf Coast Business Review sounds off every week with news on banking, law, real estate, government.
With Obamacare approved new required Medicaid spending by states, we'll add $910 million in spending to Florida's budget.
Commercial development.
On top of Florida's already overburdened regulatory schemes, Hometown Democracy Amendment 4 will unfortunately require referendums on scores of proposed land use changes.
Industry.
To get back on the road to prosperity, Florida needs to create a better insurance climate, continue to reform property taxes, and defeat Amendment 4. This will help give businesses the environment they need to grow.
The Gulf Coast Business Review, where business starts. Fresh insights, new ideas, new developments. Get hooked up with some amazing new business opportunities. They all come together in the review. Subscribe online at review.net. Review.net.
This radio healthcare program is being brought to you by the Focus on Females Education Foundation, a not-for-profit organization. Their mission is to make you an expert on your individual medical problems through dynamic and interactive educational programs. Real physicians answering real questions, speaking plain English, and giving practical, ready-to-use information on a wide variety of topics. Participation empowers families to better partner with their doctors. The result is more effective office visits, preventing unnecessary suffering, and eliminating the economic burdens of avoidable health and emergency care. We need your financial support. Donations to the foundation are tax deductible. Each and every dollar provides support so families can take control of their health. We have already saved and transformed lives for generations to come. Be a donor in what has been described as a phenomenon to reduce health illiteracy in our community. No donation is too small. To learn more about us and our free annual Women's Healthcare Symposium, visit focusonfemales.com. Donations can be made to Focus on Females Education Foundation, P.O. Box 320702, Tampa, Florida, 33679-2702. Thank you.
Studio lines are open, so get focused, get involved, and get the advice you need for your health. In Hillsborough, 289-1860, and everywhere else, 877-969-8600. Once again, our host for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
Okay, welcome back to the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic, and today we are tackling atopic disease, which, as Dr. Ledford explained earlier, is really refers to a host of different disorders, which can include food allergies, asthma, eye disease, such as keratoconjunctivitis. And we are here to answer your questions and help identify breakthroughs for you who have this disease. Now, on the line is Pamela. Pamela, welcome to the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic.
Thank you.
And you're a patient of Dr. Ledford's?
Yes.
Okay. Tell us about yourself. Oh, Dr. Ledford would like to say hi.
Hi, Pamela. How are you doing?
Good. How are you, Dr. Ledford?
Just great.
Tell us about your condition, how old you are, and what kind of atopic disease you have.
She may not want to tell you how old she is.
All right. You make up a number.
Actually, the patient is my son.
Okay.
So it's referring to a child. Okay. But I have been told to use moisturizers.
Well, how old is your son?
Moisturizers on my 7-year-old.
Okay.
And my question is there anyone better than any other that could be purchased over the counter?
Now, let's back up a little bit. Your 7-year-old son has eczema?
Yes.
Okay. How long has he had eczema for?
It started when he was about 2 years old.
Okay. And has it waxed and waned over the years?
Yes, it comes and goes. At times, it's worse, timing of the year as far as weather will affect it. It's worse during the winter months than it is during the summer months.
Okay. And so you find yourself having to increase the moisturization during those winter months?
Correct.
Okay. And have you had to use anything else in addition to the moisturizer, such as the steroid?
Yes, he has used, Elidil, he has been prescribed before, as well as Elicon had been prescribed for him in the past, but both of which are prescription,
mm-hmm.
Neither one being over-the-counter.
Mm-hmm.
So that doesn't really refer to my question. But
no, we'll cover your question. Okay, so Dennis, if you would first discuss the question, what moisturizer would be best, and then maybe also include discussion of the Elidil and Elicon, how they differ as far as therapies for the disease.
Yes, I think this is an important point because often the parents, particularly the mothers, often hounding the child about using the moisturizer, and my experience is particularly boys don't want stuff put on their skin, or they say they don't like it or try to rebel against it. Some of that may be cultural. Some of it may be the actual materials kind of make their skin sting a little bit. And in fact, moisturizers can cause a little bit of stinging. So the first thing is there is a difference between barrier creams and moisturizer creams. For example, the cream we would use for a diaper rash is a barrier cream. It doesn't really hydrate the skin, whereas moisturizers penetrate the skin, that sort of barrier of keratin, that substance on the surface that makes our skin more resistant to the outside things. Moisturizers penetrate that and actually provide moisture to the skin. My partners and I advocate what we call a wet approach to eczema, where we try to encourage soaking in a bath, and then you put a moisturizer on as soon as you get out of the bath, because it helps seal in some of the moisture that's soaked into the skin during the bath. But if you don't put the moisturizer on, it'll evaporate very quickly and leave the skin often drier than it was when you started. So it's why some people don't like to use long baths, because they feel it dries the skin out. Same is also true of swimming. After a child's been in the pool a lot, their skin will seem to dry out if you don't put the moisturizer on as soon as they get out. As far as which product, I think the main thing is to differentiate the barrier from the moisturizer and then find the cheapest one that your child likes. And I would try to experiment a little bit, but keep in mind that anything that looks really thick and white is probably a barrier, and Vaseline is a barrier. It is not really a moisturizer. So the fact that you put Vaseline on the skin does not hydrate the skin. It creates a barrier. You may not lose as much water, but it doesn't really soak into the skin to hydrate it. So I would experiment with your son and try to find things that he seems to like that you can afford that seem to provide moisturization.
Can you give a couple of samples or ideas?
Not to push any one particular product, but we like Elicon products. The Vanna cream products, the Aveeno products. Basis has a series. Neutrogena makes a series that has good moisturizing. You want to stay away from things that have a lot of smell. Mm. You like to avoid lanolin can sometimes cause irritation or even allergy. So you have to be careful changing brands all the time, because there may be even chemicals within the moisturizer that will cause sensitivity. So that's why you have to pay attention if it does seem to burn or bother the skin. And I think, though, for example, Vaseline Intensive Care, there's often a store brand product that's very similar to that, and you can look at the labels and compare. That's quite inexpensive. You want to make sure it's not too expensive, because the idea is to use it very liberally. You want to really put it all over the place and rub it in well. You don't want something so expensive you're hesitant to use it.
Okay. I just want to make a note. Bill, I know you're there. You're waiting. Hang in there. We'll be right with you in a couple of minutes. How about preservatives? Do preservatives matter when it comes to these moisturizers?
They may, and most of them do have a preservative in them, because they're products that are used over time that you have access to, so that if there's any bacteria introduced, it could cause a problem of putting it onto your skin. So most of them have some preservative. It can be an alcohol. Sometimes it's a chemical that's added. Another reason that you need to kind of experiment a little bit to kind of find the one that seems not to bother the skin
Are there any moisturizers that are over-the-counter that are preservative-free?
Usually not, because they can't sell something that you can open and put your hands on that has no agent in it to reduce bacteria for fear that... So I think you have to... Again, people generally tolerate them, though. So I think you try to find the one that seems to be the best for you. And, the, you know, organic, does that matter? Well, some people like to be organic, and I think it's fine if you can find a product that's affordable. Then I would say that's good.
So the same way, you've, in your experience, it's not been worthwhile to find a compounding pharmacy that can do it preservative-free?
We do that with some of those topical steroids because at that point the person has such severe disease, we're having a lot of trouble controlling it. We will have a pharmacist prepare steroid treatements that have no preservative in them. But I tend not to use...
Not over-the-counter either.
Right, exactly. But I don't tend to use compounded moisturizers that are preservative-free. But that would certainly be a consideration if someone has a concern. I usually find there's enough products out there that you can try a different one, and in the long run, it'll be a lot cheaper than having something compounded.
Okay.
I see.
Elidil versus Elicon.
Well, Elidil is the calcineurin inhibitor that we talked about before. Elidil would be that agent that has no steroid in it that controls eczema. And the Elicon is a mid-potency topical steroid that we would apply to the skin. They're both effective, probably for speed of onset and sort of overall impact. The steroids tend to be more effective in that sense, but they have some negatives, particularly they can thin the skin a little bit. So Elicon, being a mid-strength, would have some thinning effect, especially on the face, whereas Elidil, because it's not a steroid, it's a calcineurin inhibitor, doesn't have any thinning effect. So on the face or very thin-skinned areas, we would encourage the use of Elidil, and then on thicker-skinned areas, we'd probably use a topical steroid.
Do they both increase the risk of infection equally when in a disease that already is prone to, for infection?
I would say as far as topical or skin infection, Elidil would probably have a bigger effect on infection. But if you look over long-term use and or systemically, if you started to use steroids systemically, clearly there would be an increased risk of infection. But the main problem with topical steroids is not as much infection as it is thinning of the skin over time, which leaves the skin fragile and then easier to get infected secondarily because of the breakdown of the barrier effect.
And but the good news, I'm just one quick point, I'll come back right back to you. But the good news is that once you get off the steroids, the skin will rejuvenate itself, correct?
Well, probably, although if it's used long enough, the thinning may be permanent. I mean, I think that's a problem.
Pamela, go ahead.
And that was going to be my question, was that how, if it was used long term, what would be the side effect? What would you be dealing with as far as treatment goes to an affected thinning area that's like basically addicted to the topical steroid?
How to restore it?
Yes.
Yeah, how to restore it.
It's not really addicted, but you're right in the sense you have to use it all the time or otherwise the eczema breaks through, and so you feel like you're kind of having to use it. It's very difficult to thicken the skin or to do something other than stopping the steroid, which is where I think the Elidil comes to play. If you have an area where that's happening or developing, you'd want to move away from the steroid to the moisturizer and be very, very liberal with the moisturizer. And then maybe consider using something like Elidil if you have to control the eczema. Once it's thinned, it's not easy for us to make that thicken up again. There's a little bit of evidence that certain things like Retin A may thicken the skin a little bit, but they're also very irritating. And so it's hard to come up with an answer other than getting away from the steroid and giving it time.
Oh, okay. I see.
Any other questions, Pam?
No, I think that covered it all.
All right, we want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Pamela.
And good luck. And good luck with your son.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
All right, you too. Okay, Bill from Bradenton, welcome to the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic.
Well, thank you for your program, taking my call. I got maybe one big one here. My daughter may have leukoderma, which I say may because it was diagnosed as a fungus at one time, and it's been since her mid-teens, and very, very slowly seems to have gone from her small patches and of spots from her legs and a little bit even on her face now. I was wondering whether you've come across anything like that.
How old's your daughter now?
27.
And when did this begin?
In her mid-teens, about 15, 16.
And was this ever biopsied?
No, it was not.
And it was given a diagnosis of leukoderma?
Yeah, that's, well, I talked to a pathologist, and a man I was working with, and I described it to him, and he thought it might be that.
And it began as patches, but now it's spreading?
Well, over the, since her mid-teens, she's had a very slow progression. She has a few on her face, been there for probably 5 years or so, but not really disfiguring or noticeable. But when it first started on her legs, you could definitely see there was small spots and groups seen that were on her calf, you know, and gradually seemed to work their way up a little.
Did they itch, or are they red?
No, there was no signs of that whatsoever.
No itch and no redness, just white spots.
Right.
Dennis?
Bob, you said it was called leukoderma. That was the term that you heard?
It seemed like it might be a catch-all phrase for something.
I have to say I'm a bit ignorant here. This sounds like more of a question for a good dermatologist, which I unfortunately am not a good dermatologist.
What?
But leukoderma probably refers to white skin, and I suspect it's alopecia that you're describing, but I can't, you know, certainly say that with confidence.
I have a vitiligo.
I'm sorry, yep. I meant vitiligo, not alopecia. Vitiligo is loss of pigment. Alopecia is loss of hair. Steve, appreciate that. It sounds like vitiligo, yep, which is loss of pigment in the skin.
Exactly.
Okay, and that is can occur with eczema. Vitiligo, you'll sometimes see a sort of a whitish patches of skin. It's very upsetting to the parents because this is often on the face of a child particularly, and we call that pityriasis alba, which is just a big name for little white or faint colored spots. Those, as a rule, with eczema get better as the child gets older, and it's due to the cells that make pigment called melanocytes of being reduced by the inflammation of the eczema. In your daughter's case, it sounds like the pigment cells are reduced for some other reason, because it doesn't itch and it doesn't turn red, which in eczema it should.
Had one funny twist. When she was even younger, she had Lyme's disease. And I don't think that would have anything to do with it, because presently she's negative on our test. But that's about the only really crucial stuff she's gone through that I know of. And I think you may have a good line on, maybe it could be a mild form of eczema.
No, vitiligo, I think, or maybe, or it could, I mean, it could be mild eczema, but it should itch then. And so the thing that makes me think it's not eczema or the pityriasis alba associated with eczema is her age. Usually pityriasis alba would be getting better at this point, not continuing to spread. And the fact you said that she doesn't really complain of it itching. Eczema or atopic dermatitis itches. It always itches, and often the itching is just awful, and it keeps you awake, and it disrupts your life. And the fact that she doesn't itch makes me think that this change in color is something else, and it gets back to what Steve was suggesting with the vitiligo.
Maybe an immune response.
Yes. There is evidence that vitiligo is immunologically mediated, and this does get confusing when people hear about immune problems and they think about immune deficiency or autoimmune, and they kind of lump atopic or allergic diseases all in the mix of that. So we have autoimmune, like systemic lupus erythematosus or lupus or rheumatoid arthritis, and then we have immune deficiency, like where your immune system doesn't work effectively to fight off infections, like you hear in some very young children or in patients who have AIDS. And then you hear about allergic or atopic diseases, and although they're all immunologically linked, they're not all the same diseases, and I think vitiligo would be much more likely to be autoimmune than necessarily to be atopic.
Well, the idea of maybe getting a biopsy sounds awful good to me.
I think that is a good suggestion.
With it, which is that maybe she is on the wand, you know, as far as this goes. I haven't talked to her in depth about this. You know, I didn't want to bring up any hurtful subjects to her, but I think that it'd be a good idea to pursue this further, if she's still having the problem, which I can't say for sure over the last 4 years or so. That's, you know.
Say, Bill, how old was she when she developed her Lyme's disease?
She was probably about 10.
10. And do you remember where was it diagnosed when she had skin changes?
Oh, she, Actually, she had a mild rash, no temperature. She had the target spot, of course, which 2 years later I came across and practically had a nervous breakdown. We got her treated immediately. Then several years later, it was necessary to go to doxycycline to actually seem to eradicate it.
But the rash was localized in a single spot.
A faint torso rash. She asked me what it was one night.
Okay.
Her temperature, and I figured, well, some sort of mild virus that, you know, will come and go. And I didn't think anything more of it since she didn't seem to have and she was barely into the positive range. She was a low titer.
Right, but I guess what I'm getting at is the areas of skin involvement with the Lyme's was different than where she's experiencing these skin-like changes now.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, I don't think there's any relationship that I'm aware of specifically of Lyme disease with loss of pigment or this vitiligo that we were discussing earlier, but anything that inflames the skin, anything that causes an active inflammatory response in the skin, including, say, infection sometimes, can cause pigment changes. And we often refer to something called post-inflammatory pigmentation changes, or hyper, which means increased, or hypo, which means decreased pigmentation. So you can see those kind of changes with inflammation of a variety of types. But that would typically be associated with a specific event, and I would doubt that Lyme disease would do that.
She's
a little bit of a stumper there, you know. She, her hormones were a little bit late in developing because she was really super athletic in high school. So I don't know, you know, things may not have been given the right cues or something. But
okay. Well, listen, Bill, we want to thank you very much for calling in today and joining us, and
very helpful, and I think you gave him some good direction here.
Thank you very much. Okay, we'll be right back after a break. Call in with your questions at 289-1860 in Hillsborough County. Everywhere else, toll free, 877-969-8600. Be right back with more.
Some fishing waters have reopened in the Gulf.
These reopenings are a great start.
But people on the coast are still concerned.
The big question is how much oil is out there beneath the surface.
And there's still a lot of work to be done.
There's still oil on the water to pick up. And I just stress we're going to be here doing that until the job is completely done.
Now, more than ever, the leak may have stopped, but the struggle continues in the Gulf.
How long will we have to fight that oil before all the oil is gone from the Gulf?
Talk Radio 860 WGUL.
Buying or selling a home or commercial property? Considering building or renovating? Maybe you just need an unbiased professional opinion. Britannia Building Consultants is the answer. BBC Home Inspections have saved clients time, money, and ensured their safety over 20,000 times. BBC aims at delivering exceptional value. There is simply no equal to partnering with BBC. Call our office at any time at 727-446-0110 or visit us on the web at BritanniaBCI.com.
As we get down to the nitty-gritty in this election campaign, America's getting bombarded with misinformation, race baiting, a few outright lies. This is Hugh Hewitt. When the mainstream media spin out of control, you can count on hotair.com to cut through the spin. Whether it's on immigration, same-sex marriage, the economy, or the mosque at Ground Zero, hotair.com is the whole story. Hotair.com is free, and it will keep you connected. Log on today and feel the heat at hotair.com. That's hotair.com.
Springtime, a time for the good old pastime, a time for the crack of the bat, the roar of the crowds, and the hopes that your team may have a shot at the big one this year. Isn't it time you took control of your financial team? Let Phil's Gang help you execute your game plan this season. Go to philsgang.com. That's philsgang.com. Only Phil's Gang gives you the correct market information. Create wealth with Phil Grandy. Don't spend another year hoping your financial team will win. Take control of your team with philsgang.com. You can't afford to miss a day. Go to philsgang.com.
This radio healthcare program is being brought to you by the Focus on Females Education Foundation, a not-for-profit organization. Their mission is to make you an expert on your individual medical problems through dynamic and interactive educational programs. Real physicians answering real questions, speaking plain English, and giving practical, ready-to-use information on a wide variety of topics. Participation empowers families to better partner with their doctors. The result is more effective office visits, preventing unnecessary suffering and eliminating the economic burdens of avoidable health and emergency care. We need your financial support. Donations to the foundation are tax deductible. Each and every dollar provides support so families can take control of their health. We have already saved and transformed lives for generations to come. Be a donor in what has been described as a phenomenon to reduce health literacy in our community. No donation is too small. To learn more about us and our free annual Women's Healthcare Symposium, visit focusonfemales.com. Donations can be made to Focus on Females Education Foundation, P.O. Box 320702, Tampa, Florida, 33679-2702. Thank you.
Studio lines are open, so get focused, get involved, and get the advice you need for your health. In Hillsboro, 289-1860, and everywhere else, 877-969-8600. Once again, our host for the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic, Dr. Stephen Maskin.
Okay, quickly, we have 3 minutes left, so now is a good time to call in with a quick question. 289-1860, 289-1860 in Hillsborough County. Outside of Hillsborough County, toll-free, 877-969-8600. We have time for one more quick question. Call in now. In the meantime, Dennis, let's talk about atopic diseases and insect allergies. Are they related?
Probably not. That's another good example of something where a person has an allergy, but it isn't necessarily linked to this thing we were talking about earlier, atopic diseases. What does seem to happen is if you have atopy and you're insect allergic, you have more severe reactions. But the likelihood of you becoming allergic to insects is probably not increased by being atopic. And the same could be said with medication allergy, like penicillin allergy. That is not an atopic disease.
All right, let me cut you up here if I may, because on the line is Sonia. Sonia, welcome to the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. We have 2 minutes. Go for it.
First time caller. Love your show. Excellent.
Thank you.
My quick question is, my daughter was diagnosed with the what I think is going to be the atopic type of condition, but the eczema, then it went to dermatitis, and then it went to, we had to send her to a dermatologist. They ended up giving her steroids and putting cream on her face. Putting on a nebulizer for the breathing treatments. We've now, not at age five, she's not being having to use that. How do we know if this is going to come back? My concern, or does it, could it grow into other things? What should I look for? And I'll hang up and listen. Excellent show, sir.
Thank you, Sonia.
Great question, Sonia. And I think, again, this characterizes
the
variability of atopy over age. It changes as the person grows. But you don't outgrow it. What happens is it changes form and may become less evident, but the genetic tendency is still in her body, and she could become, for example, get hay fever. She could become cat sensitive. She could even develop a food allergy or pass this trait on to her children.
And be aware of the risk for increases for asthma as she gets older, correct?
That's right, because she used a nebulizer earlier. It doesn't mean it couldn't come back even when she's 40 or 50 years of age.
Very good. Thank you, Sonia. And thank you, Dennis Ledford, for your insights and your expertise. This is Dr. Steve Maskin wishing each of you a healthy week, and we'll see you next Sunday on the Focus on Females Radio Healthcare Clinic. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Exciting!
The best military exhibit I've ever seen.
Very educational.